You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 28th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a great show for you today. On the program, a little bit later than normal, breaking a little bit of format, Nicole Sandler arrested at that Allen West town hall, supposed town hall meeting, and then I guess maced in prison. Was it a way for her just to get a day off from her daily internet radio show? I don't know. Maybe if only we had that type of. I've already checked to see if my congressman is holding a town hall anywhere near me. Apparently not. Be that as it may, it is day two of the ongoing controversy, non-controversy over the birth certificate, which, of course, dominated the news yesterday. Instead of anybody talking about Ben Bernanke coming out and basically saying he's going to protect rich people in this country, their wealth. And for the rest of you, those of you unemployed, those of you suffering under a weak economy, well, what are you going to do? Can't please everyone. And certainly the wealthy will be first in line. We will get to that as the show progresses. But the Donald, still the front runner in the Republican, field of clowns. I saw a report that Huckabee will not be running, that he's told his posse in South Carolina, his clown car full of hicks, to go work for some other moron in the Republican field, and they have obliged. And then they came out and, of course, denying it. It is pretty it's pretty funny to watch this field of 2012 Republicans in total disarray, which, of course, enables Obama, gives him a little breathing room to not really inject what needs to be injected into this economy. And really, frankly, not just Obama, any of our Gallatin overlords. But Donald Trump yesterday, good story in the ABC News. One more reason why Donald Trump makes such an excellent Republican candidate. Now that Trump has been able to single-handedly resolve this issue of proving him to be a liar about the birthplace of Barack Obama, he will spend more time focusing on both Barack Obama's bona fides as an Ivy League graduate and, of course, as a going out and talking stupid talk on the economy. But, of course, he's one of his linchpins is accusing China of taking manufacturing jobs from the U.S. and saying nobody's doing anything about it. The president isn't doing anything about it. Quote, the problem with our country is we don't make anything anymore. If only Donald Trump was in the slightest position to influence that sad story of affairs, that sad state of affairs, I should say. Well, it turns out that Donald Trump, just like his real estate holdings, is just branded. He puts out a bunch of branded products. Because there's a lot of morons out there who want to wear a Trump tie. Because then you, too, can get your own reality show. And something sitting on top of your head, I guess. I don't know. He puts out ties and dress shirts, other clothing in the Donald J. Trump signature collection. Hats, stuffed animals, cufflinks, tie clips. The vast majority of which, apparently, are made in China.
Surprise, surprise.
I am shocked. When it comes to manufacturing, China is making all these products. They could be made in North Carolina. They could be made in Alabama. They could be made in lots of our places. And right now they're not, he told CNN earlier this year. If only there was someone who sold products under his name who could in any way influence where those products were made. If only. China is raping this country, Trump told employees at Wilcox Industries, which makes tactical equipment for U.S. military forces. If only Trump had continued to say that as someone who profits incredibly by simply licensing my name, I will only do so to products that are made in the United States, but...
I don't think so.
Selling $80 Trump-branded cotton sweaters, $70 Trump-branded warm-up tops, all made in China. Also available with the Made in China tag, golf hats stamped with the Trump crest and Trump teddy bears. As first reported by Salon.com, the Trump wear sold in Macy's, part of the Donald Trump signature collection. It's manufactured overseas, including ties in more than 50 different styles and colors, all made in China. Suits made in Mexico and Vietnam, and dress shirts, five styles made in China. And although many of his products are made in China, Trump repeatedly has complained about the quality of Chinese-made goods as compared to American products. Our companies make better product. That's very important to know. We make a better product. But yet I will not hesitate to put my name on that inferior product because I know there's a lot of morons out there who will buy it if they see my name on it. So there it is, Donald Trump, the chump, talking the talk, but not walking the walk per se. And, of course, some other interesting news. This story from, what's the name of this site? Oh, this is from Brian Kelly's Truth Squad. And I should tell you, Brian Kelly's Truth Squad is headed up by William J. Kelly, a contributor to Breitbart.com. And he edits the Tea Party reports for the Washington Times communities. So you know it's got to be true. Oh, excuse me. Let's see. April 29th. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. No, I've got it right here. Where is this? April 29th, 2011. What's that? Is that how's that from tomorrow? Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is April 21st. April 21st, 2011. That's only 7 days ago. By current Hollywood standards, it's a movie that we should have never been made. Imagine this story pitched to progressive movie execs. We have a female heroine, genius entrepreneurs disappearing, and a government conspiring to control its people and their creations. In short, a powerfully persuasive anti-government message. He writes in his piece titled Atlas Shrugged, Box Office Success Stuns. Stuns liberal Hollywood. Yet, despite or because of Hollywood's best efforts to keep the movie down, Atlas is racking up dollar signs at the box office. With a hearty $5,640 per theater in its opening weekend, Atlas Shrugged, based on the Ayn Rand has left Hollywood insiders dumbstruck to explain its success. Man, this blockbuster rolling all over. You commie liberals. Let's play a great clip from that trailer.
You and your brother try to undermine me or go to the government.
Maybe you should let me explain.
Maybe you should let me finish speaking.
Maybe you should let me finish speaking. And I will, Bill Kelly and your truth squad. What's the explanation for this amazing success? Rand power. Harmon Caslow, the film has over, according to Harmon Caslow, the Atlas executive producer, the film has overperformed in markets like Atlanta, New York, Nashville, generating as much as $12,000 to $25,000 per theater. People are hungry for what these characters are saying, says executive producer John Aguilero. They're telling the government, just leave me alone. So let me hang on to my life and pursue my passions. And let me finish speaking. That message is what's driving the success of Atlas Shrugged. Oh.
Hey, what happened?
What happened? Oh, because 4 days later, on April 25th, in the that liberal rag, the New York Post, owned by that bleeding heart liberal, what's his name? Rupert Murdoch. After a middling performance during its opening weekend that was hyped in some quarters.
Hey, what happened?
The per-screen average for this amateurish Ayn Rand adaptation plunged to an alarming... Are you ready for this, folks? $1,800 from $5,640 during its opening frame. Overall, the weekend's take was a scant $879,000, a whopping 48% drop, despite adding 166 locations. That means at some locations, distributor Rocky Mountain Pictures will be writing checks to theaters to cover the difference between receipts and operating expenses.
Hey, what happened?
The only way they're likely to get the 1,000 screens the producers say they want next weekend is to rent them. Let's play that clip again.
You and your brother try to undermine me or go to the government.
Maybe you should let me explain.
Maybe you should let me finish speaking.
Oh, such drama. Will this man be interrupted again? Or will his pleas to the person he's speaking to allow him to finally finish speaking? Surely rubbing salt in the producer's wounds is the performance of Robert Redford's left-leaning The Conspirator, which also added screens in its second weekend and managed a decent hold and almost 3,000 per location average. So let's return to the Truth Squad. If, as he says, this thing was a huge juggernaut, it must be that people are not hungry for what these characters are saying. They're telling the government, just leave me alone, let me hang on to my life, and let me finish speaking! That message is what's driving the success, I should say, or the failure of Atlas Shrugged. So there you have it, folks. Atlas Shrugged big time. Part two, every reason to believe it should be opening on a YouTube screen near you. If the actors are willing to take like a free version of Fountainhead or something like that. We're going to take a break. Folks, we'll take your calls in the body of the show today, 646-257-3920. Or you can reach us through Skype at Majority Live, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. When we come back, Ben Bernanke, Helicopter Ben, decides to, keep his helicopter grounded, as it were. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report yesterday. Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke gave the first press conference in the history of the Federal Reserve Chairman, I guess. And as I mentioned yesterday, we were setting this up. The question, we were hoping the question would be posed, and in fact it was, why is not the Federal Reserve pursuing its, or at least one half of its mandate, which is to increase employment in this country, at a time when inflation is well under control? Core inflation is below 2%. Why is Bernanke not easing the money supply? In other words, injecting more money into the economy to help create growth. And understand, this is, he gives this press conference on the day before, which would be yesterday. Reports come out today that the U.S. economy has slowed to a crawl in the first quarter. It has slowed to 1.8%, at least annualized, in the first quarter. And one big part of this, now you'll read stuff like, well, it's because the weather was bad. Well, the weather is always bad. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. 1.8% is not described by the weather. One big reason for this slowing growth, the federal government spending sank by 7.9%, much faster than the 0.3% decline recorded in the fourth quarter, and local and state government spending fell 3.3% compared with a 2.6% drop in the last 3 months of 2010. So in other words, 2010, we had much better growth. But now we're starting to see the beginnings of austerity. Just the beginnings of it. And Brad DeLong at his blog simply writes, contractionary fiscal policy is contractionary. The less money the government puts into the economy, the less it grows, particularly at a time where we don't have the private sector spending money, investing money, hiring, period. Which is why we have projections of greater than optimal unemployment. Well, maybe there is no optimal unemployment. That has sort of been debunked. But 5% is considered adequate. And there's no projection that has us reaching 5% for 5 or 6, 7, 8 years. At best, and it's certainly not going to happen with 1.8 annualized growth. So let's go back to what Christine Romer wrote February 26, 2011, when she talked about the division amongst people who believe that the Fed should be fervently controlling inflation. Or at times of crises like this, which I guess anybody except for our wealthy elite in this country would perceive 8.9 as a minimum unemployment, because it's probably higher than that, a crisis. She says the real division is not about the acceptable level of inflation, but about its causes, and the dispute is limiting the Fed's aid to the economic recovery. Empiricists, she writes, as the name suggests, put the most weight on the evidence. Empirical analysis shows the main determinants of inflation are past inflation and unemployment. Inflation rises when unemployment is below normal and falls when it's above normal. Because if you have unemployment below normal levels, it puts inflationary pressure on wages, which then puts inflationary pressure on the goods and services that those employees provide via their employers. Theorists, on the other hand, emphasize economic models that assume people are highly rational in forming expectations of future inflation. In these models, Fed actions that call its commitment to low inflation into question can cause inflation expectations to spike, leading to actual increases in prices and wages. Well, some of this inflation would not be a bad thing. Some theorists oppose monetary expansion on other grounds, like the fear of setting off asset price bubbles. But the main division is between the empiricists who say inflation is unlikely at 9% unemployment and theorists who say inflation could bite us at any moment. These differing views have come to a head around the Fed's policy of quantitative easing. Now, do you remember when they introduced this idea of QE2? We're going to buy $600 billion worth of treasury bonds. Do you remember all of the doomsday scenarios of what this was going to do for inflation? It was only 6 months ago. Google it. People were talking about this is going to destroy the dollar. This is going to create havoc in the streets. It's going to spike commodity prices. It's not hard to find these articles. And
hey, what happened?
Nothing. We got a little economic growth, which has been stifled now by and mitigated by the lack of government spending. And yet, yesterday, not only did Bernanke announce the end of QE2, but as reported by Matthew Iglesias, he basically spent the whole press conference. I'll read this. Only the New York Times' Benjamin Applebaum asked about the Fed's timid approach to the economic recession. In other words, why are you not loosening even more the money supply to create and stimulate growth? Bernanke basically said that fixing the labor market would be too risky. After all, quote, if inflation expectations, this is the theorist now, expectations were to become unmoored, the cost of that in terms of employment loss in the future would be quite significant because the Fed would need to respond with tighter money. In essence, Iglesias paraphrases, policymakers are saying that they're okay with high employment today because if they take drastic steps to eliminate it, they might get inflation. If that happens, then they need to provoke a new round of unemployment to cure the inflation. Which, of course, is ridiculous. It's okay for us to have high unemployment now for 5 years because it's possible that if we try and fix it, we may need to return to high unemployment. America's central bank has a dual mandate, and it's supposed to both avoid inflation and elevated unemployment. Michael Woodford, the author of the leading monetary economics textbooks, explained months ago that the way out is for the Fed to act boldly now to ease unemployment, but also to clarify that it will allow a one-time only inflation increase with the understanding that it will implement a plan to curb it once the target level of prices has been reached. The Fed has a target level of inflation that I think is around 4%, yet they're not aiming for that. They're trying to keep it around 2%. Iglesias writes, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that demographic biases are driving policy at this point. Unemployment is lower for college-educated people than for those with only a high school diploma. It's lower for white people than blacks and Hispanics. It's lower for middle-aged people than for the young. Not coincidentally, both the Federal Reserve Board and the United States Congress are full of middle-aged white people with college degrees who mostly socialize with other middle-aged white people with college degrees. The editors of major business and political publications look pretty similar. The result is a bubble in which condemning the country to years of higher than necessary unemployment as a precautionary measure seems to make sense. And with fiscal policy off the table in Congress, it looks like those of us outside the bubble are just going to have to live with it. Now, I have an additional theory, and perhaps people who are smarter about economics and finance can correct me if I'm wrong. The other night, I went out to dinner with a buddy of mine who is easily the most wealthy person I know. I'm not even clear on what he does. I know that it has to do with finance. He paid. And we were having an argument about this, and I can only go so far in the argument because we both know that he knows more about this finance than I do. But I also think it's a matter of perspective. And so I said to him, you know, the Fed in 2008, 2009 was essentially lending money to these investment houses at 0% interest, and they were selling it back to us or loaning it back to us at 3%. And he was only vaguely aware of that. I sent him some information. He said, well, this still carries some risk. It sounds like it doesn't, but it does. He said, if long-term rates go up, the value of your bond goes down. And you could get rid of that risk with an interest rate swap, but that would also cost you a certain percentage, which would cut into your risk. He says, the point is, this is not without risk, because if treasury bonds go up, if there's inflation, and the value of these bonds become less, they're going to have to raise the interest rates. And he said, that's where the risk lies. So I would suggest, and I'm certainly open for a clarification, that maybe one of the reasons why Bernanke so strongly is averse to any type of easing that would create any inflationary pressures, that would actually hit the target rate of inflation that the Fed says is its own goal, is to continue to allow these banks to make money so that there's less of a chance that they ultimately will find themselves as bankrupt as we know they are. I don't know. But I do know that it's quite clear that there is very little interest amongst the elite in this country to provide any type of relief for the extended unemployment we have. And I don't know, maybe at one point Obama will perceive this as a political liability, and maybe it doesn't happen for another 4 or 5 months when we start to see that growth is incredibly anemic in the second quarter as well. Remember, this is before we have these draconian budgets passed. This is before we have the draconian austerity that is awaiting us. And meanwhile, we have this Medicare budget, and people are starting to fight back. Nicole Sandler was at one of these Alan West meetings, just one of many town halls where people are speaking back to this. There's more and more data showing that seniors, who theoretically would not be affected by Ryan's plan because it doesn't go into effect for 10 years. Now, of course, you will be affected if you're 60 or if you're 65, presumably if you're alive at age 75. But then I guess the hope is that, you know, it rains that day, you're not interested in voting. But Harry Reid has committed to making the Republicans in the Senate vote for Paul Ryan's budget, which is a pretty smart political move, because it's going to force people like Collins and Snow and Scott Brown and this Heller, who is going to be appointed John Ensign's seat in the Senate, to vote on this and be on record for trying to destroy Medicare. And we're seeing, you know, I hope we're seeing more and more people across the spectrum starting to protest what's going on. And I don't know if it's a function of what happened in Wisconsin, but I'm starting to think that this type of direct action is the only thing that that's going to be effective. which is why I've been encouraging people to go out to your own town halls, your own congressional town halls, raise the stink, videotape it, audio tape it, send it along. There was down in Tucson, apparently, the United School Districts, the Board of Education there, I guess, is attempting to cut funding for Mexican-American studies in their high school system. Apparently the only such type of studies in the nation. And this is an amazing video. We have it posted on majority.fm, or we shall. And so all these students, I'll just set the table for this audio. You see people gathering inside the school board meeting thing. There's a dais, and there's a bunch of seats up there with the little placards. And there are students outside the room sort of protesting, giving speeches. And then all of a sudden, about a half a dozen to a dozen students inside the room sort of give themselves a signal. They rush the stage. They bring these huge chains. They fight through this big old fat security guard who is trying to grab essentially the weakest high school student he could find, like, you know, the skinniest girl he could find there, trying to keep her from chaining herself to these chairs. These kids all chain themselves to the chairs. They essentially take over the meeting and they start chanting. Here's some of that sound. There you have it. You have these students, we will not comply. Our education is under attack. What do? Fight back. And they ended up shutting down this meeting and making it essentially be canceled and rescheduled for May 5th. But, you know, it's great for these kids to be learning that they can have an impact on what goes on in their community. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nicole Sandler, host of Radio or Not at radioornot.com. She was basically trying to ask a question of, well, we'll let her tell the story, but she's a jailbird now. Was maced, apparently, in prison, too. In jail. We'll be right back after this. Back on the Majority Report, Sam Cedar on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to this program Nicole Sandler. She is the host of Radio or Not at radioornot.com. Fresh off of her show, which is 10 to noon. And conveniently, ours goes for another 20 minutes or so we can have you on. Nicole, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam. It's good to talk to you.
So yesterday I played this video of the Allen West Town Hall where you were taken out of the meeting because you were asking questions of him. And then I guess this cop, I don't even know if he was on duty, decides he didn't like the fact that you had a problem with him manhandling him, and he decides sort of randomly to arrest. Well, tell me the story.
You know, it's weird, and probably the video you played is the one that this right-wing member of the audience shot, which doesn't show the audio. If you want, I mean, I can play it, but it won't translate well. I've got it posted at radioornot.com, so you can see it. He, you know, it was billed as a town hall meeting. It wasn't a town hall meeting. It was a presentation and a speech. He was... we weren't allowed to ask questions. You had to write your question down on a card, and then Allen West staffers went through them, decided which ones to ask him, and then he, you know, gave his right-wing talking points in lieu of answers. So, so he was asked a question about Medicare, and he gave that, you know, bull about, oh, you know, we're going to let the free market handle it. And I shouted out something to the effect, and I was sitting second row center. He knew I was there. He could hear me very clearly. I said, how is privatizing Medicare protecting it for future generations? How does adding a profit motive to it make it more efficient? I said, and what insurance company is going to insure a 75-year-old person with obesity, high blood pressure, and diabetes? That's the answer, the question I wanted to ask, because I don't care if you have an $8,000 voucher or you know, a $50,000 voucher. No insurance company, for-profit insurance company, is going to write that policy and insure that person.
Right, of course.
So while I'm trying to ask what I believe is a real, legitimate, important question, I was ejected from the meeting. I was told by one of his brown shirts, "You need to leave." And a Fort Lauderdale police sergeant pulled me out. And from the video you saw, I mean, the video you had didn't show my full question. It just had me shouting like a maniac, which is not what was going on. You do hear me, I think, telling the cop who was manhandling me that I wanted his name and badge number.
Right.
And he said, whatever you need. And then he said, now you need to leave. And I said, fine, I'm leaving. And as I was saying that, he started pushing me. And I said, get your hands off of me. And as I continued protesting and telling him to get his hands off of me, he said, that's it, you're under arrest. So, you know, in the police report, he wrote, and I don't have it up right now. Let me see if I can find it. He wrote something to the effect of that I was continuously pushing him.
Wow.
Really?
Wow, he really should have taken a look at the video that I saw. Because he is going to have some fairly significant problems if he signed that report, because
yes,
the
did.
Video very clearly, and you know, you should probably get somebody to sort of take a copy of that video, because that video very clearly it never cuts away from your exchange with the cop, and it clearly shows that you never touched the cop. That he was just pissed that you were attempting to videotape his response to the badge and the name.
You're absolutely right. You know, he was pissed that I talked back to him.
Yep.
That I dared to challenge his badge and say, you know, get your hands off of me.
Yep.
But he
yep.
did sign. Not only he wrote the report. I'm trying to find it right now. Where he said that, you know, the suspect continue. You know. Hold on one second. My phone's right. It's a crazy time. I'm trying to find it as we speak. So here it is. Okay, here's his probable cause affidavit. Arrested was at a town hall meeting for Congressman West when she became very disruptive and loud, interfering with the meeting. Her behavior caused
people to question the Medicare proposal.
Yes, exactly. Her behavior caused many of the audience members to enter into a verbal altercation with her that threatened to become physical. I instructed defendant to leave the property no less than a dozen times. That's not true. He did a few times, but it was not more than a dozen times. Defendant kept stopping, refusing to leave. No, because I said, I'm going. I'm out of here. And as I attempted to escort her out, she became physically aggressive with this officer, pushing me several times.
Wow.
Defendant was finally placed under arrest.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That guy better, I hope he has Google, and we'll see a nice video of himself not doing that. So then,
yeah.
So, and the video follows you out, out of the building, and the guy's getting a little bit, he's starting to squeeze your arm a little bit. I'm not quite clear as to why, but, and
yeah.
Then what happened? You were maced in the prison?
Yeah. You know, Sam, you know, we don't know each other that well, but you've heard me. I have a big mouth. And I'm sorry, the way they treat people who have not yet been arraigned, they've been accused of a crime of some sort. They've been arrested, but have not yet had a day in court. And I was under the impression that there's some pesky thing like a law that says that suspects are presumed innocent until proven guilty.
Well, I'm not exactly sure what you would be presumed. What were you arrested for? For being physical with the cop?
No. That was the description. The actual charge is trespass after warning, for
wow.
which I it was a $25 bond.
Wow.
Whopping $25 bond. Yeah. So but I'm not only talking me. I'm talking about the other women who were in this cell block with me. They treated us all like dirt. And so I'll give you the short version, which basically is there were four of us who were left in this area when others were taken out to see the magistrate. And they wanted to clean the cell block. And so they put us in one of the cells that wasn't being used to house prisoners. Now, these cells are about maybe at its widest point, 7 feet by 10 to 12 feet. And I'm probably being generous there. And they put three people in each of these. Three people, one of them on sort of a cot and two on these inch thick mattresses on the floor. I got the one next to the disgusting toilet that doesn't look like it's ever been cleaned. It was lovely. And so they put four of us in one of these cells that wasn't being used because it was being used to store at least 50 of these mattresses piled, right? And they just stuck us in there ostensibly while they were cleaning the outside area. But then they forgot about us and left us in there for at least an hour. And when the door finally opened and I said to the guard, what did you forget about us? He said, yeah, that happened. Or something snide like that. And I said, you know, I think you owe us an apology. He went, oh, yeah, I apologize. And I said, no, seriously. No, we're human beings. You lock us in this storage room where there's no air circulation. You really owe us an apology. And he said, oh, yeah, you want an apology? See upstairs, cell number one, get in there. There's your apology. You get all the air you want by yourself. And he locked me in there in solitary confinement for at least 3 hours. And when they finally came in like with lunch and I said, can I please get out now? He said, no. I said, please, I'm really, really sorry. Can I please come out? No. And so he gives me my lunch. You know, they crack open the door a little bit, give me my lunch, and then it slams shut and locks. And about a minute later, it opened again. And I thought, all right, maybe the guy does have a heart. And so I stepped out. I sat on the top step right outside the cell. I didn't even go downstairs where all the other women were sitting at the table. And he saw me and he started screaming, get back in the cell. And I said, no, please just let me sit here. And he said, are you disobeying an order? Get back in the cell. And as I started to protest again, I said, no, please let me sit here. He starts spraying the mace in my face.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, jeez.
And I mean, I'm sure I screamed. I understand that they videotape, constantly have tape rolling in these prisons. So, you know, they better have preserved that tape because I believe I have a lawsuit there.
Wow.
I think I've got
wow.
a few lawsuits right now, actually. The way I was treated is so, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been maced.
No, not by anybody who wasn't a loved one.
Okay. Well, let me tell you, it's nasty. I mean, my eyes burned. They felt like they were on fire. I couldn't open them. I couldn't see. I couldn't see the metal sink in the room. And then, I guess I stumbled back inside the cell so he would stop macing me. And it wasn't just like a shh. It was shh. I mean, he all over my eyes, my whole face, in my mouth, up my nose, in my hair, to where what I found out later, they had to move all the women from that cell block into another cell block because their eyes were burning. And then, I started screaming, I need a doctor, I need a doctor. I'm screaming and crying and probably blood-curdling screams. Then they finally escort me to like the nurse's area and they, you know how they washed out my eyes? By holding my head under a running faucet. So now, not only do I know what solitary confinement feels like, I think I know what waterboarding feels like is, they're holding my face under there and the water's going up my nose in my mouth and my eyes are burning. I mean, this whole thing was unbelievable. I'm just still shocked by what happened. It's surreal.
It really is. It is stunning when you compare what, that suddenly, let's just, for the sake of argument, assume that you were being disruptive. Let's stipulate that for a moment and just compare that to the scenes that we saw over in 2009 over the health care bill. And I don't recall anybody ending up maced. I don't recall anybody being arrested at these town hall meetings. It's stunning.
Not even escorted out. They were allowed to stay there with all their, instructions on how to disrupt and disturb a town hall meeting.
Well, it's true. I mean, there was absolutely there are public people have posted online these memos on how to disrupt the town hall meeting, and it's pretty stunning, Nicole. And I'm sorry you went through this, and I hope that. I hope that you get a lot of opportunity to tell your story.
Thank you. I do. And I think I'm going to be on Cenk Uygur's show tonight.
Great.
On MSNBC. And, as I explained, look, I just on my show, and by the podcast will be up, the video archive is probably already there on my website at radioornot.com. And I spent the first 90 minutes just from start to finish. Consider it my deposition explaining exactly what happened. But look, Sam, you and I know what it's like to invite people on your show and then they say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm tired, I'm da, da, da. So I am doing shows because I know what it's like to be turned down. And this is what we do. So,
I appreciate your coming on and I'm really glad that you're getting your story's getting out there. I mean, both in terms of, obviously, what happened to you in a specific way, but also it brings more light to what's going on across the country in terms of, both in terms of the your points to be made about Medicare and this Ryan proposal, and also, frankly, the lack of coverage and the sort of the lack of seeing this as a legitimate protest on behalf of the people. I mean, Republicans only seem to care about the Second Amendment, not so much for the First Amendment. So maybe you should have brought a gun.
No. That's just not how I roll.
I hear you. Well, Nicole, I appreciate it. The show, radioornot.com. You can go see live every day, 10 to noon Eastern, and podcast available at radioornot.com as well as the video podcast, I guess.
It's video file,
whatever. Nicole, thanks so much,
Sam.
Again. All right,
thank
folks.
You. Bye-bye.
We are done for today. You can join me on the flip side at, you can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, or Majority Live. We'll be right back after this. Oh, and a reminder, I will be riding shotgun with Pap, filling in for Ed Schultz right after the show, immediately following the show. In fact, I got to figure out how to get an apple or something. I'm going to pass out. All right, join me on the flip side. You can IM me. We'll be right back.